So, Kevin, how are you, my man?
I'm doing good. It's early here, but I'm limping along, and I'm excited to be here.
Oh, well, it's an absolute honor to have you, man. I've been loving your content, and I'm all about the bullshit filters and anyone who's speaking the truth out there and debunking misinformation gets my respect straight away. So I appreciate that, and I know I'm pretty sure you get a lot of pushback from the information you put out there.
I appreciate that a lot, and I get an insane amount of pushback every day. It's like you've got people that love it, and you've got people that absolutely do not. So it's a mixed thing there for sure. But overall, it's very rewarding because I know that, especially when people like you message me and let me know how you think about what I'm doing, it makes all the difference because I know that I'm actually helping people in their lives. So,
What sort of got you to this point where you're offering people real information?
It is a long story, and it really goes back to me being a kid, but I'm gonna start you how I was feeling before med school, because it could take a while. So if I told the whole thing, so I started being interested in sort of the obesity epidemic. I was about to start medical school. I was looking for something to sort of give me a direction as I underwent medical training. And one of the things I was interested in was the obesity epidemic, because obesity underlies so many of people's health problems. Obesity and their nutrition issues, people eating ultra-processed food, junk food, it underlies so many people's health problems. So my thinking was, if we solve that problem, if we make, you know, the food system better and how people eat better, then we can just in sort of one stroke drastically improve a lot of people's health. So I was very interested in that. I thought it was so obvious what we needed to do. Everybody would agree on it, which was one of the things that was appealing about working in that area, because it just seemed so clear. But then as I got online and I started talking about this with other people, I started to see very clearly that there was actually a huge amount of disagreement. There's all sorts of different camps about what we should do about obesity, what diets people should have, what are the good things, what are the bad things. Some people said animal products are bad. Some people said, no, it's carbohydrates are bad. And other people have all sorts of different strange ideas about how we're actually supposed to address the poor health that we're seeing in so many people these days. So then I started thinking, well, why is that? I started digging into the claims of different people, and especially the more extreme claims. And I started to see, oh, well, a lot of this isn't actually based on evidence. A lot of it's based on conjecture, speculation, and it's poorly supported by, it's poorly supported by evidence, and in some cases, in many cases, actually contradicted by the evidence that we actually have. So then I started to realize, okay, if we are constantly arguing about what is causing obesity epidemic, is causing people's poor health, then how are we actually as a society going to address this problem? If we can't come to any consensus, then we can't actually make any policies. We can't come to any agreements about what we need to do. And so we're going to keep having this problem. So what happened is I started thinking, well, in order to actually address the obesity epidemic, we need to address the misinformation problem going on online. So that's where I am. I'm trying to address the misinformation problem, try to help people produce one perspective, at least on my channel, on at least my social media. Here's this one perspective I think is correct, so that we can at least, I don't know, for me, like step by step, little by little, maybe contribute to people having a greater awareness of what science, evidence, et cetera, actually says, as opposed to what it doesn't say. So maybe someday we can have, an impact on a societal level. I mean, now it seems like so pie in the sky, but yeah, at minimum, I can at least make a small difference in the individual people's lives, and that makes a big difference. So
yeah, huge, man. And yeah, as much as there's an obesity epidemic, there's a misinformation epidemic at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Something you're trying to counter, you're trying to, in your own information, trying to push back against and give some people real evidence-based researched information.
Yep, definitely.
What are some of the things that you have found that has been perhaps pushback by society or pushback by other people in the medical field, possibly.
What do you mean?
Some of the more popular arguments or more popular topics there for tackling obesity that's being projected by other people in the media or other people in the field that you don't agree with.
Okay.
Is it as simple as having a calorie restrictive diet and being more active, or are we missing a lot more?
That's part of it. I mean, so I think it ultimately does come down to that in the end, but to get there is really where the battle is, or where people need information. So it's easy to say, hey, you just need to eat less and move more. But like, that's like saying, I don't know, I think I remember whenever I used to like go to clubs and bars and stuff, and I would try to approach women, and I would have like friends and stuff or whatever, or even some cases I would give this advice to them. One of the bits of advice people would give to each other is like, oh, just be confident. Like, just be confident. But like, you're like, wait a second, like, how do I be confident if I don't know, like, how do I just do that? I can't just like will that, you know? And I feel like the idea of just eat less is the same sort of idea. How do I actually eat less? So I think there, understanding why people are overeating is extremely useful, because in order to know how we're gonna eat less, we actually need to know why we're overeating. The current theories that I think are the most prominent among the best in the field, the best obesity researchers, is that we have foods that are basically what they call hyperpalatable, which just means that they taste really delicious, and they are calorie dense, which just means there's a lot of calories in a small little package and it tastes really good. And these foods have been created on the market in a sort of iterative process of constant improvement towards this end of getting you to eat more of them. So think of all your favorite packaged foods, or our least favorite packaged foods, for that matter, at least with respect to weight loss, that taste really good and that will make you fat if you eat too much of them. These foods have been created as a result of a very long evolutionary process of competition between different companies to get you to eat more of them. And the companies that figured out the formula to get you to eat the most did well, and the ones that didn't do as well. And then there was competition at another level again. And so iteratively, we've got these foods that are making people obese because of the market has produced these foods that sell the best. So the foods that are selling the best are the most obesogenic, and basically the market itself is creating obesogenic foods because of the competition. So yeah, what are the characteristics of these? I already listed two. Basically they're hyperpalatable and they're calorie dense, and I think those are the two main ones. So if you want to try to reduce your calorie intake, you want to eat foods that are not so delicious. I mean, if you think of like what I have in front of me right now, I have a bowl of oatmeal, and I just got up because, as I mentioned, it's 6:15 a.m. here in the United States. It's a bowl of oatmeal. I do add a little bit of sugar on it, or not sugar, but like sweetener, like monk fruit extract, and then erythritol, and that makes it taste a little bit better. But like, I don't add a bunch of oils into it. In addition, you know, I don't add a bunch of butter. I can, if I need those calories, if I'm like desperately in need of those calories, but I try to avoid that. So I try to make the food taste relatively good, but I don't like try to make it taste really delicious. Although I can to some degree with the sweeteners, the artificial sweeteners. So I try to limit the calorie density, and I don't try to make everything taste the most good that it can possibly taste. Yeah, and then I think another thing that is sort of a black box in addition to those two factors is sort of keeping things relatively unprocessed. We don't know why processing tends to cause foods to be more obesogenic, but like maybe it's the lack of fiber, maybe it's the reduction in protein content. There's many different things, but in general, focusing on keeping the foods minimally processed as opposed to things that you get from a package. But of course, that's very difficult for many people because there's time issues, there's resource issues, how are you going to cook all your food, et cetera. And so one of the things that I personally do that I know that other people do is I do like meal prep. I actually have meal prep on the weekends where I just have everything made for the entire week. And that way I can avoid this issue of like having to spend all of my time during the week cooking and making food. So that's how I do that. I have a big freezer where I actually put everything and then I microwave everything throughout the week. That's the way that I do it. So ultimately I end up having like kind of industrially produced food, except it's industrially produced by me. So it is very convenient, but I think those, I would say calorie density, hyper palatability, and the level of processedness are some of the three main issues with respect to reducing calorie intake. And then there's a bunch of other issues independent of calorie intake that also impact health. For example, sodium content, saturated fat content, fiber content, whether it's an animal or plant food, the protein content, et cetera. But yeah, as far as reducing calorie intake is concerned, the main things are going to be calorie density, hyperpalatability, and the level of processedness. And the rest is sort of building off of that sort of on the margins, which those other factors do have an impact, a significant impact. But what I've mentioned there, those three things are probably the main base to build on when you want to think about how to reduce your food intake. So it's not necessarily carbohydrate content. You can have, again, I can have a bowl of oatmeal. I'm not going to get fat off of if I just eat bowls of oatmeal a day, I'm not going to get fat. It's going to be really hard to do that. It's going to be almost impossible. Unless I start adding like butter to it. If I start adding a bunch of butter and then I start adding a bunch of sugar, then yeah, maybe we can start thinking about getting fat on all the bowls of oatmeal every day, but it's not the carbohydrates themselves. Likewise, if I eat just chicken breasts, right, I'm not going to get fat because I'm eating animal products because it's just chicken breasts. It's going to be very difficult to do that. So those are two of the main myths is like animal products are making people fat or carbohydrates are making people fat. In both cases, it's not necessarily true because you can eat both of each without getting fat. So that's some core principles, and those are some ideas that I think are wrong. And
I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, just to sort of narrow it down then, in terms of a couple of the buzzwords that are out there at the moment, and protein is one of them. Depending on you, if you want to build lean muscle mass or if you want to drop some body fat, eat more protein seems to be the constant messages out there with either of those goals. Is it overemphasized? Is the protein intake overemphasized, or is it as important as these people make it out to be?
I think if you want to maximize your body composition, if you want to get shredded, if you want to get jacked, I think protein is a really important factor in that. The difference between consuming, say, a high protein diet and a low protein diet, like not, say for low protein, like not even meeting the government, the government recommendations for the average person versus say, which is like less than, 0.8 grams per kilogram, at least in the United States, and I'm sure it's similar in Ireland, versus, for a bodybuilding person, which we often hear something like 1 gram per pound or like 2.2 grams per kilogram body weight. The difference between that is really large as far as your long-term outcomes are concerned. Now, in the short term, it's not going to be something you're necessarily going to see like huge differences in your body composition, but over time, as you train, the benefits will compound, and the difference between somebody who has a high protein intake and a low protein intake in terms of their lean mass, in terms of their fat mass, is going to be substantial. Now, I think the impact of protein on satiety and on weight loss is definitely overstated. So, for example, again, this is like oatmeal is one of the best foods that you can eat as far as like having a lean or having a healthy body weight is concerned. So, for sure, oatmeal is great. If you only eat oatmeal, though, are you going to have your optimal lean body mass versus your fat mass? And I don't think you will. You're not going to significantly impact your overall body weight, but you won't maximize your body composition. So the way that I think about protein ultimately is it helps to maximize your body composition by increasing lean mass and reducing fat mass. So there's sort of a a body recomposition effect or a nutrient repartitioning effect towards lean mass and away from fat mass, whereas other factors are much more important with respect to controlling your body weight, and protein only has a relatively small impact in that equation. So that's how I think about protein.
Okay.
And I think the science is clear on that.
Mm-hmm. And then if you were to shift the focus towards some of the supplementations that are being advocated out there at the moment, are there some that you stand with in terms of their level of importance? I know you've spoken about vitamin D, for example, and that being quite significant. Are there other supplements then, such as fish oils, such as creatine? Not creatine is well researched, and if there's any, do you have any hesitancies about creatine? Is there any supplements out there at the moment that you feel are being, again, over, their importance is over exaggerated, and they're really not that, it really doesn't matter as much?
Yeah, I think, well, we can start with creatine, because I think creatine's great. I think creatine, I'm not even sure creatine has downsides, except maybe if you're like an endurance athlete and you want to keep your body weight relatively low, you're going to, of course, add a couple kilos when you start taking creatine, I guess anywhere between 1 and 3 kilos, depending upon your body mass and depending upon how much creatine you already have in your muscle. Mm-hmm. So if you're an endurance athlete, creatine is not going to help you as much, because it doesn't tend to help those energy systems within your muscles that are important for endurance exercise, like strictly speaking. But if you are any sort of like strength athlete or combat sports athlete or anybody who uses a lot of anaerobic kind of systems in the anaerobic energy systems, then creatine is going to be great. The other thing about creatine is there's some indication that it can help improve cognitive function, especially in people who don't eat as many animal products, and people who eat more, maybe a little bit less of an improvement. But certainly I think it helps to buffer against, say, sleep deprivation, against like cognitive stress, that kind of thing. Whenever you're feeling stressed, whenever you're sleep deprived, apparently, or the evidence seems to indicate that can sort of provide a buffer and help prevent some of the negative effects of that. And also, there's a substantial amount of evidence supporting this idea that it can help to prevent brain injury and can promote healthy brain aging, although those pieces of evidence are a little bit more weak. But I'm actually most excited about that, because that's one of my areas of most interest. I'm interested in how to help cognitive function. So yeah, I think creatine is good all around. The only thing that you should be worried about a little bit is if maybe you're an endurance athlete. If you are somebody who's worried about weight gain, the weight gain from creatine is entirely in the muscles. It's just going to make your muscles a little bit thicker, and it will only make you look better, unless you're like, I don't know, already like 300 pounds of muscle or something. But in which case, I don't think you're worried about creatine. So I think for everybody, creatine is awesome. I would recommend creatine for everybody. I love creatine. So now we can start there, and on that positive level. On vitamin D level, there's some positives and negatives. So I think the positives have been dramatically overemphasized. It's been mostly done on the basis of observational data that are probably not, it's hard to get into the details here, but it's probably not indicative of the actual real effects of vitamin D on health. That said, I think there might be some immune benefit to vitamin D, especially with respect to cancer risk. So if you're very lean, if you take vitamin D supplements, and I wouldn't take a lot, and we'll talk about them in just a second. If you're very lean, it can, there is some indication in some really rigorous studies, although it's hard to know for sure, and we don't know 100% for sure, but there's some indication that it might decrease some cancer risk marginally. The downside of vitamin D supplementation, however, is that it may reduce your bone mineral density. So at higher doses, just even as low as, what is it? Even as low as, it's either 4,000 or 2,000 international units. It might be 4,000. Yeah, it's 4,000 international units. In some study, well, in one good study, really rigorous study, it showed that people randomized to that level of vitamin D supplementation saw decreases in their bone mineral density. Now, this is only over the course of maybe 2 years, so they didn't see any significant changes in bone strength, but one can imagine over the course of, say, 10 to 20 years, that would end up translating into decreases in bone strength if those decreases in bone mineral density continued. And it does seem to be the case that they do. So over the course of the study, people in that group kept having reduced bone density over time, bone mineral density over time. And the same thing goes for a group that was assigned 10,000 international units. So what do I do? So for me, I started out deficient in vitamin D. That's why I became really interested in it. I don't know the units in Ireland, but I started out like really, really low in the single digits for the units that we use over here. So I ended up having to supplement. But I think that one shouldn't be too aggressive in supplementation. So for me, I do 2,000 international units, and I think that that works out well for me. But I also have really, really high bone density because I've been doing weight training for a really long time. So people who have been doing weight training for a really long time and they have high bone density, I think vitamin D is a relatively safe bet. It's not going to produce dramatic benefits across the board in health that many people will promise, but there may be some small benefits to, for example, cancer risk, maybe some mood and emotional benefits potentially if you're deficient, if you're starting out on a deficient basis. But those benefits aren't super well established, but those might actually be counterbalanced by some bone issues if you're not starting at high levels of bone density in the first place. So if you're starting, if you're say a woman and you're worried about your bone density, then you might be a little bit more circumspect about your vitamin D supplementation. Ultimately, we don't have the answers precisely about who should get vitamin D supplements and who shouldn't. The stuff that I'm telling you right now is really on the edge of what the science is. If you go talk to, say, somebody who's in, say, they formulate recommendations for official bodies, they'll tend to be even more conservative about this. If you're deficient in vitamin D, according to relatively conservative guidelines and a conservative cutoff, then I'd say it's definitely a good idea to supplement, but you don't need to supplement beyond that. And I think there are some risks to doing so. So that's kind of the overview. And I know that's a little bit fluffy and not entirely clear, but the fact is we don't exactly know and have a super clear idea about vitamin D yet. But it's certainly not as big a deal as a lot of people make it out to be. So
it does depend on the climate you live in. Like if you're exposed to a lot of sunlight, then you need less vitamin D supplementation.
Definitely. Yeah.
We live here in Ireland and it's cloudy and rainy 300 days a year. So we would need to supplement vitamin D more so than someone that lives in the Caribbean, for example.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's what the data shows, that people closer to the equator tend to have higher vitamin D levels for sure. So, but you can get a test from your doctor if your doctor wants to give it to you. But if you get a test, you can find out whether you have low or not vitamin D levels, and you can decide from there if you have access to that.
All right. Just to sort of move on to, because this podcast, we're mainly speaking to men here. And of course, for a lot of men, they want to improve or increase their testosterone levels.
Yeah.
Is there some information or some nuance out there that you've debunked about increasing your testosterone?
That's great. I've done some stuff, like for example, there's this guy named Andrew Huberman who's telling people that he ate butter in order to increase his testosterone. He thought that the dietary cholesterol in butter, because it's his cholesterol is a precursor to testosterone. The body changes cholesterol into testosterone. If you ate more cholesterol, then you are going to increase your testosterone. Well, that's not the case. I mean, because even if you take a statin medication, for example, and you reduce your cholesterol by 50%, which is what even a low dose statin will often do, you'll only reduce your testosterone by like, I don't know, it's like 2 or 3%. It's like clinically insignificant amount. So your body's testosterone production doesn't depend on your blood cholesterol. The cholesterol is going to be synthesized within the testicles themselves. And the blood cholesterol has a negligible impact on how much testosterone your testes are going to be producing. If you're interested in increasing your testosterone, increasing your blood cholesterol isn't the smartest way to do that anyway, because your blood cholesterol, especially in men, is going to impact your cardiovascular disease risk. And so the more cardiovascular disease that you have, many things stop working. especially like sexual function, et cetera. So it can be end up being counterproductive if you take that approach, and it doesn't work anyway. So what I'll say is, I know that there are now, especially now, there are some supplements definitely coming onto the market that are marketed as testosterone boosters. I haven't gotten a chance to look into those yet and debunk them, so to speak. We do have, I mean, if you get a test and you see that you're low in testosterone, I'll tell you this, your testosterone levels can impact your well-being. It can impact your mental well-being. So if you are clinically low in testosterone and you increase your testosterone levels above that clinically low level, mental well-being will increase. It's not just a factor of your muscle mass and your sports performance, although that will also improve as well, but mental well-being will increase, which is super important. So I would say if you find yourself at a clinically low level of testosterone, you can try the supplement boosters. I haven't debunked and looked at them in depth yet, and I need to, and I will. But one of the ways that this is often treated is there are different drugs that people can use. I would say the main way to start, if anybody's looking into that, is probably not to start with exogenous testosterone. It's probably to start with something called HCG. That's because HCG will increase your testosterone production sort of endogenously, and you won't be shutting down as many processes. Also, HCG won't shut down your fertility, whereas exogenous testosterone, the mm-hmm. the stuff you inject, although you'll inject both of them, will shut you down in terms of your fertility. So maybe a safer bet would be to start with HCG, and then if that doesn't work, then you can try exogenous testosterone. In most cases, the HCG will work. But as far as testosterone boosters are concerned, I don't know about those drug supplements as well as I want to, and I will be learning more about that and communicating more about that in the future.
Yeah. There's a few kind of supplementations that are being floated around there in terms of their importance with increasing testosterone levels. I think zinc is one of them.
Zinc, yeah. Apparently zinc might have an impact on testosterone levels. Yeah.
But the only way really is that you are going to go through a more rigorous process of injecting yourself with what you call it, HCG.
HCG, yeah, that would be what you get prescribed from a doctor. I'll say this, the probably the biggest reason a lot of men have low testosterone levels is excess body fat, because testosterone gets converted into estrogen in the body fat. And then when it's converted into the estrogen in the body fat, it actually can then in turn turn off your testosterone in addition to that. So not only are you're losing testosterone from the conversion into estrogen, but the estrogen itself then actually turns off testosterone production even more. So one of the best ways to increase testosterone in somebody who's overweight is to lose the body fat. That's going to be one of the go-tos. And you can do that in a natural way, increase your testosterone, reduce your estrogen, get better overall well-being through body fat loss. So I'd say that would be a go-to for somebody who's having low testosterone but having excess body fat.
Yeah. And of course, there's other things as well being promoted to improve your testosterone, such as saunas, such as heat, cold exposure, and intermittent fasting as well seems to be something quite popular.
Really? People are saying that they should use sauna and cold and intermittent fasting to increase testosterone. Well,
yeah, that heat exposure will have a benefit to your testosterone levels. That
wow.
Again, you could do either or you could do all of them if you're crazy enough to do so. Or cold exposure will improve your testosterone levels. Or intermittent fasting as well will have benefits.
The one thing I'll say there is I don't think heat has ever been shown to improve your testosterone, increase your testosterone. I'm not sure about cold. I haven't looked into that. I don't think there's any change in your hormones through sauna. I will tell you this, though, that sauna will, especially if you do it frequently, will decrease your sperm concentration and your sperm count quite significantly. There was one study that was recently done where they did sauna 2 times a week for 3 months, and they saw a 75% reduction in sperm concentration. And that's just twice a week for 3 months. So if you're trying to conceive or have children, I think sauna is a bad idea. Fortunately, it doesn't affect your testosterone production in the testes. But again, like you can tell, men have a scrotum. Our testicles aren't inside our bodies. They're outside our bodies for a reason. That's potentially costly for them to be outside our bodies. So that's a really good reason. There has to be a really good reason for them to be outside our bodies. And that's related to the fact that sperm production doesn't happen very well at higher body temperatures. You need a lower body temperature. So if you're having sauna, you are basically frying your sperm, especially if you're doing it often. So I'd say that. Otherwise, you know, if you're trying not to have children, then maybe having sauna often is a good idea. So it's not, I don't think it's going to affect your testosterone levels. Intermittent fasting, that's really interesting that you brought that up, because a recent study was published, a review study that indicated that you might actually have reductions in sex steroid production with intermittent fasting. I will say this, in the short term, intermittent fasting will probably reduce your testosterone levels. If you have excess body fat and it's helping you to reduce your body fat, then it may, in the long term, help you to increase your testosterone levels after you've normalized your body weight at a lower body weight. That said, intermittent fasting hasn't been shown to be especially effective compared to other strategies. So other strategies are just as effective as intermittent fasting. But if you want to try intermittent fasting, you can. One method that's been shown to be equally effective to intermittent fasting is simply having consistent meal timing. So just eating at the same times, being mindful about the times that you're eating and eating in a structured manner and not snacking is going to be roughly as effective in terms of your body weight loss as intermittent fasting. So that's something alternatively that you could try. Now, does intermittent fasting itself, simply the fact that you say reduce your food intake to one or two meals a day in a small window, does that itself, even maintaining the same body weight, cause reductions in testosterone or sex steroid levels, estrogen levels in women? I'm actually not sure. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I wouldn't imagine that it actually helps you to have better testosterone production. I can't imagine why you would expect for it to be better. But some people also say that something like sauna and especially alternative heat and cold exposure will help to increase your growth hormone. And it will. Just a slight tangent, but it's important because this kind of idea gets circulated. It will help to increase your growth hormone, but that's not going to have any clinically beneficial effects. So even if you do get increases in your growth hormone due to that, you're not going to get any positive changes to your body composition. And the same goes for intermittent fasting. Fasting also increases your growth hormone, but you're not going to become jacked and huge and muscular because you're fasting. It's the opposite's going to happen, even though your growth hormone is changing. So one shouldn't necessarily chase these biomarkers, even if intermittent fasting did increase testosterone levels to a small degree, it might not be clinically significant, and there's some signal that it doesn't. So one should probably chase things that are going to have a big impact and not major in the minors. Using intermittent fasting, sauna, and heat exposure for increasing testosterone or growth hormone levels or hormone levels in general is majoring in the minors. You want to focus on the things that are going to have the highest yield. These sorts of modalities for chasing these kinds of biomarker changes are not going to have super high yields, I think, is the take home there.
What's your general opinion on intermittent fasting aside from testosterone production?
Yeah, if people like it and it helps them, yeah, that's great. I think on average, it's not going to be better than, say, simply like consistent meal timing, or it's not going to add anything to calorie restriction. And that's been shown in multiple different studies at this point, a recently released one. And then there's an unpublished study that was presented at one major obesity conference about 2 years ago that was very well done, that showed the same thing. It's not going to add anything additional to most strategies to reduce weight. So you're really legitimately not going to get a whole bunch of an additional effect if you're already being super mindful about how you're eating, about your meal timing, about how much you're taking. You're not going to get anything additional from just adding intermittent fasting. But if you're just starting in your weight loss journey and it's something you want to try above all the other strategies may seem cumbersome, or you don't want to count calories, or there's other things you just don't want to bother with it, and you like intermittent fasting as an idea, you can try it and you'll see some benefit. You'll see a significant reduction in weight as a result of doing that. But I would just say keep open-minded, because if you want to try something else, you can try other things without losing all of those gains. You just need to be mindful and have different other strategies for doing the same thing. And adding intermittent fasting on top of that is not necessarily going to help you very much, probably not much at all. So that's what I would say. It's a good starting strategy for a beginner, but it's not necessarily going to add a great deal to other strategies.
And aside from a weight loss perspective, does it have any other benefits from a cognitive perspective, for example, or performance perspective? Energy?
That's interesting. So some people report there's a few things. Some people report in the morning feeling sluggish after they eat breakfast. I've definitely experienced that for sure. So anecdotally, I've noticed that some mornings I get up and I'll eat something and I'll want to go to sleep again. You know what I mean? I'm not sure where that effect is coming from. I know that effect is real because I've experienced that so many times. Mm-hmm. And then what people will do is they'll use intermittent fasting to avoid that effect. For me though, if I do that and I avoid that effect, I just kind of push it off till whenever I eat my first meal. So if I wait, I don't know if you've had experience. I've had this experience. If I break my fast instead at noon instead of the morning, I'm just going to crash at noon. You know, I'm just gonna have the same crash I would have anyway. In some ways, sometimes it'll be worse. I'll need to take a nap in the middle of the day. So, that's what I'll say. So I do think there's some impact of eating on feeling sleepy, especially when you're breaking your fast. So I don't want to downplay that. But what I will say is that the studies that have been done on the acute effects of fasting on cognition and on mood tend to be negative. So people tend to do worse in their cognition whenever they fast for long periods of time. Now, this may be unrelated to this whole effect of sort of putting off one's breakfast in the morning. You might actually get some short-term. I noticed that I might in the short term get some benefits, but in general, fasting tends to decrease cognitive performance. It tends to decrease your mood. It tends to make you more irritable. I know anecdotally myself that if I've that whenever I switched from doing intermittent fasting to eating, throughout the day, I became a much more pleasant and tolerable person. Yeah, that's where the short-term data tends to indicate. And we don't have any long-term data. So some people will say, well, if I adapt to intermittent fasting, if I get used to it, will things get better? I think probably things will get better, but it seems to me unlikely that things will reverse. So it's not like your body learns to tolerate intermittent fasting and then suddenly you start thriving on it. Usually what happens in these kinds of cases is if you have something that's stressing you out and you're not doing well with, usually you'll just get more resilient at dealing with that and it won't suddenly cause some great enhancement. So I would be surprised if chronically the results of intermittent fasting enhanced cognitive function and enhanced your mood, whereas the short-term effects did the opposite. I would be surprised about that. But I think it's likely that you'll produce tolerance or you'll not notice the effects as much in the long term if you do it for a long time compared to the short term. The one caveat I'll put on that though is you can often just get used to something and then it becomes normal. So say you become irritable on intermittent fasting and then you notice in the long term, hey, I'm dealing with it a lot better. I would just say for people who think that to try going back to not fasting. And I would say in a substantial number of cases, people will see a night and day difference. It may just be that people are just normalizing their irritability and being things are not so bad. I would just say try it the other way again and see if you feel better, because I think a lot of people will notice that they will feel better. And I just say this because in my case, I was a fasting zealot. I believed in fasting 100%. My life got so much better when I started eating throughout the day as opposed to fasting. That's just my personal opinion. Maybe other people who are more by their sort of personality a little bit more laid back, they might tolerate it a little bit more. For me, as somebody who finds things irritating often, I didn't do so well with intermittent fasting. And I'll say this, if you fast mice, right, they do the same thing, they eat each other. If you fast mice and put them in say cage, you do experiments with fasted mice, they have to be separated and put into different cages because they will eat each other if you fast them. And I would suggest that maybe there might be a similar effect in humans as well. So So yeah.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm speaking about the fasting is it's something I've been practicing for probably over a year now, about a year. And of course, I looked at some of the evidence and the research, and I'm sort of, my sort of approach when it comes to trying anything new is just to try it and see how I feel with it. And I've been doing this for a period of time, and I do feel like I do have more focus and clarity in the morning times where I do the bulk of my work. So generally I'd work, do most of my work from say 7 a.m. till 2 p.m. and that's when I'm generally fasting. And then from 2 p.m. onwards, I'll eat my meals. And also saves me time as well. I don't have to leave my desk and go and cook a meal and do whatever I need to do. So it improves productivity. So that's why I'm asking the questions. I'm quite curious about it from a personal perspective too.
For sure. Yeah. No, I felt the same. And I think you're probably right. It probably does. Like, for me though, that increase in productivity kind of made me a little bit edgy, you know, like on edge, which is good. Whenever you're trying to like get stuff done, you're trying to crush stuff in the morning. That's like a good state to be in. But like often I'm around other people and there's some downsides to that as well. So yeah, no, I hear you. And I've experienced those effects as well.
Yeah. In terms of building lean muscle mass though, do you feel it's a counterproductive approach because meal timing and frequency of meals and frequency of especially protein intake is so important for muscle?
Yeah, 100%. I think, yeah, we're definitely on the same page there. Yeah, the more frequent you get your protein, probably the more chance you have for that sort of anabolic stimulus of the protein. And so you're probably going to get more gains. But again, if that's your strategy for reducing calorie intake, you still might take that trade-off in order to stay leaner. It's sort of a personal thing. But all else equal, if you take the same number of calories probably distributed over a larger, you know, a larger window, you're probably going to do better for your lean body mass in the long run. Are these effects going to be really large? Probably not, like compared to everything else. There's so many other things that are important for gaining and maintaining body composition, but there may be some small marginal effects as far as lean mass is concerned.
Okay. Can you give us some idea in terms of what your general nutritional intake looks like?
So right now,
what you eat.
Yeah. I'll tell you what my optimal is, because right now I'm broke. So I'm eating enough to just like maintain what I have and maybe increase it a little bit slowly. But I love protein shakes, especially like there's this company in the United States. It's called Premier Protein. It tastes like liquid ice cream, and it's just like pure protein and like artificial sweetener. I love it so much. And I love drinking those because I really do believe that protein is important for body composition. So maximizing your gains, of course, training intensity and that kind of thing is also super important. And of course, calorie intake is also important, but protein has an important effect. So I love drinking those protein shakes throughout the day whenever I have the money to do so. But apart from that, and I'll drink like 5 or 6, it's ridiculous. Apart from that, I eat, again, you know, as you can see, I eat oatmeal. I didn't have a chance to add anything to it. I like to eat most of my calories or as many calories as I can in the morning, because there's really, I think, really robust evidence indicating that all else equal. Now, again, if you're very lean and you're very fit and you're otherwise in great condition and great health, doing more calories in the evening may not have as much of an effect on your metabolic function as if you're maybe more overweight. But for me, I've noticed that if I try to get more calories earlier in the morning, it seems to me, and this is supported by the research, it seems to me that I do better as far as staying leaner and still having good performance. So I tend to focus most of my calories in the morning. I have to have a really big breakfast, as big as I can, with a bowl of oatmeal, and then I'll have mixed berries, like dark berries, like raspberries, blueberries, and then there's another in there, blackberries, I guess. I mix that in with the oatmeal. I have an artificial sweetener as well. Then I have another bowl of, and so it's like a substantial bowl. It's like this big. And then I'll have another bowl of, in addition to this, as I mentioned, I put in the freezer, all the food I have in the week. So every single day I have the same thing. I eat the same thing and I don't ever get tired of this. I know other people might. I enjoy the taste every single time. I've been doing this for like over a year, the same exact thing every day. I have two containers filled with, there's mixed vegetables, like stir fry vegetables. So it's going to be like snap peas, green beans, some peppers, mushrooms, those watercress things, and broccoli florets. And I have some of that on top of like lentils. So lentils are a really healthy food for, like in general, like as far as carbohydrates are concerned, if you want to eat carbohydrates, beans or legumes are a really good choice for that. So I have like, I think 200 grams cooked of that on top. And then I have on top of that, some sardines. So like a can of sardines. And sometimes I'll add something extra, but usually that's sort of like my base meal there. And then I'll have one of those in the morning as well. And then I'll finish up the berries. So I have a container of berries that I take some of the berries to put it on my oatmeal from. I think I have 500 grams of those. So it's quite a lot. And I finish that up as well. So it's a really big breakfast with berries, the vegetables, lentils, sardines, and then a big bowl of oatmeal. I have that early in the morning as soon as I get up to start the day off. And also have like a, and so then I'll, from that point, I have two more containers. One is the same thing of the lentils, the vegetables, and sardines. The other, and then I have some nuts. So then based upon my physical activity for the day, I'll eat all of the nuts, so 100 grams of mixed nuts. I'll eat all of those nuts, and I'll eat the other container of, you know, the beans, the vegetables, and the sardines. I'll eat the other container later in the day. And then often I'll have another small bowl of oatmeal in the evening after I do like training. So I like to do jujitsu and wrestling and then like lift weights later in the evening. Or like right after that, I'll tend to have another bowl of oatmeal. But again, throughout the day, I like to have these protein shakes to add more protein, because it doesn't sound like I'm getting a lot of protein, and I'm not without the shake. So I could add like lean meat if I was. Personally, I tend to eat more of a plant-based diet. I don't eat a lot of bland animals. I'll eat some beef. I don't eat chicken and eggs, and that's just like a personal ethical preference. It's not related to the nutritional quality. If you're interested in adding more like protein from animal sources, though, and not just following like me eating, drinking shakes and eating like mostly a plant-based diet with some fish, what I would do personally to do that would probably be to add like chicken, like lean chicken. That's going to be your healthiest option. It's going to be highest in protein, lowest in calories. And the kind of fatty acids in the chicken are going to be the healthiest for your heart. That's what I would do. I wouldn't add a whole bunch of red meat. I know that there's a lot of people who think that that's a good thing. You can, if you do eat red meat, I would say to try to make it as lean as possible. Again, that's going to be good for your heart. And again, good for maintaining weight. If you have that high protein intake, there's going to be a good amount of bulk. Also, there's like a lot of water in meat, so it's good for satiety. Mm-hmm. Not because of necessarily the protein intake, but because of the food itself is a very satiating food, like especially lean beef. So yeah, that's what I would do. Eggs are all right. If you're going to use eggs to replace like junk food, it's probably going to be good for you. It's probably going to be a net positive. If you're going to use eggs to replace like really wholesome foods like oatmeal, like beans, like vegetables, like fish, and I think maybe even like chicken, I think it's not as good. There's some discussion about this, but yeah, if you're going to replace unhealthy foods, eggs is a really good idea. If you're going to replace more healthy foods, it's either neutral or maybe not as good. That would be what the research tends to indicate. So not to say that they're necessarily bad. I would say moderation might be the good. I feel bad saying this because eggs are such a delicious food. I used to eat like tons of them, and they taste so good. They feel so good. Like it feels good eating eggs. But I think that's what the research tends to indicate. It's probably due to the dietary cholesterol. Now, the dietary cholesterol in most people is not going to increase their blood cholesterol, maybe about 80% of the people, but in about 20% of people, it does. So one way to check this is to, and most people aren't going to do this, but so that's why I just give a blanket recommendation. Most people are not going to check their blood work. You know, it's an idea in theory, but most people are not going to like take out eggs and then check their blood work and then add them back in and check their blood. Most people are not going to do that. It's just like I've never done that. And I know about this stuff. It's just like, who it's a pain. But 20% of the people will have an increase in their blood cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and it does play a role in heart disease. So I don't know. So I went off on a long tangent on eggs, but that's what I would do if I was going to eat more meat. I would focus on, say, lean chicken and lean beef if I was going to add more meat to the diet. And the reason I wouldn't add more fish is because I'm already eating 2 cans of sardines a day, and there's some potential for toxicity. I will say I have noticed symptoms of toxicity. I haven't gone too high in fish. You know, like I have like weird sleep disturbances that go away like consistently if I stop eating so much. I'll always limit myself to just 2 servings. And sometimes if you eat salmon every day, depending upon the source, you'll actually get like toxic symptoms. Like some sources are perfectly fine, other sources are not. So I would say to be careful about overdoing it on the fish. That's why I would say focus more on the land animals instead. And of course, whey protein is an excellent choice as well, which is kind of what's in the premier protein that I drink. Is a milk protein. It's a fantastic choice, and many protein supplements are great. So that's what I'd say.
Do you tend to lean more towards organic foods, or again, is that something you've debunked?
There's not a great deal of support for eating organic versus not organic. I would say the main thing is making sure that you get your, say, vegetable intake. I don't think if you're focusing on, so is my kale organic or is it not organic? I think the main thing you're going to focus on is like, am I just eating the vegetables? I think that's the thing. I think when you look at how these things are regulated, the pesticides, the herbicides, et cetera, you know, see, I haven't done a video yet on this, so I'm still, the one question I have personally is when you eat organic, you're not getting a no pesticide food. And often people think that there's no pesticides in organics. No, there are pesticides in organic foods. It's just they're organic pesticides. And some organic pesticides are actually worse than many non-organic pesticides. And that's an interesting caveat. That's like a really interesting caveat. So there's like really important copper herbicides. Those copper herbicides are terrible for you. Like they're really super toxic. So just because you're, you know, getting higher levels of non-organic pesticides or herbicides, say in the blood, there's studies showing higher levels of those, doesn't mean you're not getting other toxic chemicals. What I say probably on average when you're eating organic versus non-organic is probably better for your body, probably, but the impact is really small. And to the degree that nobody's ever measured it. Nobody's ever gone and had a study and shown in the study that, oh, if I eat organic versus non-organic, like I literally have changes in blood markers. No, besides simply the concentrations, which are extremely small in the blood of these non-organic herbicides and pesticides, there's never been documented any change in health markers, you know? So that's the one thing I'd say, like, it's speculative. Oh, is it going to have an impact? Well, within the concentrations that the regulations have, say that these foods are supposed to have, no. And even when the foods exceed the regulation amounts, they do sometimes. So sometimes they'll look at the residue concentrations and they'll see an excess of herbicide or pesticide concentrations in some foods like that they sample. Even whenever that's the case, these regulations are done so that it's like the way that the cutoffs are done is that it's like 100-fold less, or maybe even 10,000-fold less than you would ever see any effect. And these are like small effects in like lab animals. So you're getting like, it's a huge, huge, huge margin of safety. So whenever you're getting like twice the toxic limit, according to these organizations, you need to understand this is like 1,000, this is like 100 or 10,000-fold less than you'd even see a small effect in an animal. So it's unlikely to have any health effect. And it's never been documented that there is a health effect of these herbicides and pesticides. So, but if you have the extra money to do it and you want to spend that extra money, I do think it's a really minor issue and probably a non-existent issue, but you may get some small reduction in pesticide and herbicide exposure that may not be clinically significant by eating organic versus not organic. I think that's the rough view to have.
Just to sort of go back there as well on one of the things you spoke about was the eggs. And I was actually quite surprised that still 20% of people would have a negative impact on their cholesterol levels. So
yeah.
As I believed, again, I haven't done as much research as you have, of course, but that was debunked, that eggs do not have a correlative effect on your cholesterol. So this is, you're reversing this now again, and it does. And again, eggs being seen as one of the better foods for muscle growth, because it's a complete protein with all 9 amino acids. So, but at the same time, you would not replace a lean chicken breast, for example, with an egg or with eggs.
Yeah. I would say, lean chicken breast, fish are probably better sources, or lean proteins, lean milk proteins are probably better as far as getting those anabolic effects without getting the cholesterol effects. Now, as far as the increase, so most people are not going to get an increase in their LDL cholesterol levels, their blood cholesterol levels, as a result of egg consumption. But it's believed, according to the current understanding and the current set of studies, it's believed that about 20% of people do see an increase in LDL cholesterol as a result of egg consumption. So, and if you're already, and if you're not taking in a bunch of dietary cholesterol in the first place, although most people are, but if you're not, the effect of eggs might be bigger. But if you're already eating meat and stuff, it's probably not going to make any difference. But there is a small number of people. So it ends up being, the message ends up getting simplified that, it has no effect because most people don't have an effect. It does, and say 1 in 5 people have an effect. But that message has gotten oversimplified to say there's no effect at all. And of course, some studies, so if you compare egg consumption to a background diet, say the standard Western diet, I think eggs tend to show benefits, but if you compare it to, say, like higher quality diets, then eggs tend to show more of a harm. So it depends on like what your background food that you're comparing it to is. So that's why I say it depends on what you're replacing eggs with. But then often, again, that message often gets oversimplified. And so depending upon the study design, et cetera, the people say eggs are beneficial or eggs are harmful, or eggs have no effect whatsoever. Compared to a normal background diet, like the standard Western diet, eggs are probably not going to have a negative impact and may have some benefits. But it, again, depends on what you're comparing it to.
Okay.
So there's always some nuance, but that's why I don't like talking about eggs, because I know they're great for muscle growth. Like I used to eat literally like 1 to 2 dozen a day whenever I was in college and I got really, really big. And they're great for muscle growth, but there is some concern. But whenever I went to the doctor, the doctor said I had high cholesterol levels, and I got these pluses and minuses.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Well, look, as I said, I've got so much information from you, and there's so much more I could derive, and we could go down many rabbit holes, but it could be something for our future podcast. And for the time, we're absolutely loaded with information. And for any of the guys listening to this, if they want to find out more about you and the work that you do, where's the best place to get you at?
So the best place, the stuff where I'm releasing most of my stuff now, is going to be on my podcast or my YouTube channel. So the podcast is The Kevin Bass Show, and you can find that on, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. You can also find me on YouTube, where I'm releasing, basically, I'm just the same thing. I'm just releasing an audio format on the podcast, and I'm releasing in video format on YouTube. It's not like, when you watch the YouTube, you're not like, wow, I'm gaining so much more. I'm just like talking into the camera. But if you like watching as opposed to listening, you can find me on The Kevin Bass Show, or you can also search for KBass Philadelphia on the YouTube, and then my channel will pop up. And then on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, you can find me at Kevin and Bass, KEVINNBASS. You can also find me in the same place on Patreon if you want to support the stuff that I do. So that's where you can find me on social media.
Nice one. I will add all those links below. And thank you so much for your time and for your brilliant information. Keep putting it out there. I love the stuff. So I appreciate your work, Kev.
I appreciate the appreciation, and I appreciate you having me on. So this was a lot of fun.
Nice one. Until next time.
Thanks.